Welcome, everyone, and you are listening to The Last Dinosaur, and I'm your host, Chris Aversano. On today's podcast, we have Reverend Mark Nesselhut, President and Executive Director of the Siemens Church Institute. For those of you that don't know, the Siemens Church Institute advocates for the personal, professional, and spiritual well-being of merchant mariners around the world. Founded in 1834 and affiliated with the Episcopal Church, though non-denominational in terms of its trustees, staff, and service to mariners, the Siemens Church Institute of New York and New Jersey, SCI, is the largest, most comprehensive mariners service agency in North America. Reverend Nesselhut has experience in nonprofit organizations, pastoral counseling, volunteer management, governance, and in public speaking, and holds a Master's of Divinity focused on ethics and contemporary society, a Master's of Arts focused in international relations, foreign policy, and a BA in economics. Welcome, Reverend Nesselhut.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me. Appreciate you having me on the show.
Oh, this is fantastic. I've been a longtime advocate of SCI going back to my days as a cadet. I know we've talked about in the past. But for those that don't know, you know, bring me up to speed on the role that you have and that SCI plays in kind of what seafarers' lives and how that interaction works. Because I think a lot of people hear the word church, they get nervous, but I think it's a lot more than that. I know it is.
It is indeed. And you know, church is embedded in our name going back to the 1830s. So we've been around, we've been at this for quite some time. But really, even the mission we started at with the 1830s is really the same mission we do now. It's advocating, supporting, and caring for seafarers writ large. So, you know, back in the 1830s, seafarer welfare, ship visits looked a little different. It was all about making sure that seafarers weren't being exploited or taken advantage of. So we started by setting up boarding houses and then reading rooms and then expanded to hotels. Whereas now, most of the ship visiting we do is actually done out of the International Seafarer Center in Port Newark or along the coast and riverways through our Ministry on the Rivers program and Gulf. But it's basically getting to meet the mariners where they are here and now and making sure that they feel supported, whatever their needs might be, whether that's transportation, SIM cards, anything we could do to try and improve their day. So that's sort of what we would say is what Siemens Church does or SCI does around the pastoral care ship visiting piece of our mission. Secondly, you know, in the 1830s, one of the things we wanted to do was to improve seafarers' lives by adding stability or bringing about stability so they could marry and settle down. One way to do that was to help them to advance their careers. The best way to do that was through continuing education. So we set up navigation schools so that we could actually help train mariners to advance their careers through the ranks, be able to earn more money, put down roots, support a family. All of this was designed to try and improve their lives over the long haul. We still do training. We now do training on simulators. We have Kongsberg and Wärtsilä simulators at two campuses. And we do continuing maritime or mariner education in addition to feasibility study work to try and make sure that we have environmental impact studies or statements as well as safe navigation is preserved when a new bridge or a dock or something like that goes in. And then advocacy is another thing we've done. Again, we've always wanted to advocate for what was going to improve the lives and the well-being of seafarers. And that started in the 1870s with passing laws and lobbying U.S. Congress around when seafarers could leave ships because the 13th Amendment did not apply to seafarers. You could not leave a ship. It was sort of press servitude. And we continue to stay involved at the International Maritime Organization in London, the International Labor Organization in Geneva, with U.S. Congress and also with the United States Coast Guard, again, advocating for improved working conditions for all mariners. So that's sort of what we did then. It's kind of what we do now. It's our bread and butter.
Again, going back to the experience that I always had was very positive. Everything from getting a knit cap, which we could talk about that in a little bit, which I still think I have somewhere around here, to being offered a ride on a kind of a jitney service that you had. And I thought at the time when I was a young third mate that this was only for foreign seafarers. And you're like, no. I remember the guy in Corpus saying, no, I'll give you a ride to that. I think it was an HEB in Corpus. It's probably still there. Do you have a seafaring background or what made you be interested in this sort of role? Or was it just the fact that you get to sink your teeth into something new?
Well, my own background is I was a recreational sailor from the time I was a young child going off to summer camp and really enjoyed that aspect of sailing. But then when I graduated from college, went into the United States Navy. I went into the Aviation Officer Candidate School in Pensacola and basically completed that, went into aviation intelligence, and then served for 4 years in the United States Navy and really enjoyed that aspect of what I was able to do. Sort of a privilege to serve the country. It also made some good friends and some wonderful experiences and memories coming out of that. Then I did work in production secured energy lending in New Orleans, which got me exposed to the oil and gas side of all of this. But eventually went to Divinity School when I was 32, and then served in a few different places, Boston and Chicago. But I spent 13 years as the rector of a parish on the Chesapeake Bay, where many of my parishioners were Chesapeake Bay pilots, Delaware River pilot, tugboat captains with Moran and Bouchard. And my parish boundaries, actually in St. Michael's, Maryland, included the Calhoun campus of MEBA. So we would actually have a lot of MEBA students who were training there who would sort of come through our ways. And we do actually a lot of weddings for them over the years. So I think I was always around seafarers, always really appreciated that lifestyle. And then when this opportunity was available to me, I think they looked at somebody who was an Episcopal priest, had served in the United States Navy, had been to sea, and had worked around mariners and thought, well, maybe this might be a good fit. I often say I think I have the best job in the Episcopal Church, if not in all of seafarer welfare.
Well, I think you and I joked. I got to know Reverend Nesselhut with sitting on the dais and having some conversations around CMA when I was the president of CMA before my term ended. And I asked Reverend Mark, I said, who do you answer to? And he turned to me, so well, I answer to God. I said, well, that's not what I meant. being my background, I thought there was a bishop, but you do mention you have the, I think at the same time, you said that at the time as well, that you have the best job in the Episcopal Church, because it does relate to this. So one thing that I, you know, we have seen, obviously you talk about the history, the near 200 year history of SCI, because you're not too far off from, you know, 88 years or whatever it is off the top of my head. That's a long time to be around. And certainly the focus has always been around the seafarer and around some of those high points, but certainly that's, especially in the last 10 years, has changed with the advent. And we talked a little bit about this, which really made me think about you coming on the podcast. With the advent of social media being everywhere and being in the fabric of the sailor's life, especially for those, and if you don't know, I'll put it in the show notes, you know, the SCI has a training center on the Western Rivers. And for those that aren't familiar, there's a whole backbone of basically the economy that moves goods up and down the Western Rivers to get it out further down the Mississippi River or inland. And you deal with a lot of the sailors there. Talk a little bit about how social media has kind of changed their lives, and sometimes for the better, sometimes for the not, and you know how you guys have to deal with that as a ministry.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And so let me do two things. Let me broaden that and say, let's look at sort of international seafarers and U.S. domestic mariners. Really, I think it's less about social media per se, and more about just connectivity or internet access for all seafarers. And that's really one of the reasons our International Labor Organization around the Maritime Labor Convention of 2006 was to amend that most recently at the meetings in last May, or earlier this May, to try and enshrine or ensure internet access for all seafarers while at sea, which is a heavy lift. I think it's a great goal. And I also think it's sort of a generational issue. Call this the last dinosaur. I think, you know, to use a great analogy that incorporates dinosaur is one of the analogies that talks about dinosaurs, immigrants, and natives. And that's with regard to digital usage. So there are dinosaurs. I would put my mother and people like that in the category who, you know, they kind of do a little bit of social media and a little bit of using the internet, but it's not their thing. It's not something they rely on as much as maybe many other people do. And then there are people like the two of us who, you know, you and I weren't raised with iPhones. We weren't raised with laptops. We certainly weren't raised with the internet as young children, but we've embraced the technology. We've figured out how to use it. So we've sort of immigrated into that way of being. The generation behind us, the kid, you know, people that are our children's ages, they're natives. I mean, from the moment they got up, they were, you know, they had iPods and iPhones and access to all this sort of digitalization and use of the internet. And, you know, one of the first things you can say is, I don't know the answer to that. Why don't we Google it? You know, when your four-year-old says that to you, you know that it's pretty much part of who they are. So I think this next generation, the current generation and the generation we're trying to recruit into being seafarers, into being that sort of crucial workforce, are all digital natives. And so their expectation is access to the internet, access to social media is just like access to water and food. It's an expectation they have, and they bring that to their evaluation of what kind of career choice they want to make. It doesn't matter if they're coming from the United States, if they're coming from from the Philippines, from India or Malaysia, most people by and large assume that access to social media and the internet is the norm now or normative for their life. And it's a great asset because it allows us to stay in touch with what's happening with our families back home, our friends, with pop culture, all those kinds of things. There are some downsides. The downsides are that, and I'll give you a case in point, we are typically first responders to crises, fatalities, casualties on the river, and sometimes get called in by companies to assist in delivering sort of that bad news. And there was an incident where a mariner was on a vessel on the river system, or either in the ship, actually on the river system. His wife and daughter and son were in an automobile accident. The wife and daughter were both killed. The son survived. And so company reached out to us, wanted our chaplain to go on board to break the news to the mariner. By the time we got to the vessel, a neighbor had texted the person saying, "Was this your wife and daughter involved in this automobile accident?" So that immediacy and people not always being respectful of how it can best be used is maybe a drawback to it, because you can't control or sequence information in ways that we could have done it before, perhaps, you know, from a military perspective, when you get the telegram saying, you know, "I'm sad to inform you that your son or daughter has died in combat," or something like that. But I think overall, access to social media, being able to feel connected to people back home and to people you know, is a positive.
The other piece to that, yeah, it is a positive. And I could, you know, just thinking about it from my days of sailing, and I only sailed, you know, for a handful of years in the mid-90s. I remember everybody had to like run to that one potential working telephone on the dock, you know, which was yeah, you laugh, but you know, been there, done that. And I look at the connectivity, but I also look at, you know, I think we talked a little bit about in the past, maybe almost too much connectivity, and sometimes that becomes a distraction. I mean, even just, you know, my oldest is at college, and she had to deal with some stuff, and you know, but she's constantly, you know, texting my wife, and even though we're not dealing with, you know, being maybe out of contact at some point, it still becomes a distraction for both parties as you deal with this. And my wife's not piloting, or I'm not piloting a tow with 30, with 30 tows going down the river with a river, you know, rushing behind you, and that could get a little distraction. You know, you look down at your phone and, you know, that can get distraction. So certainly, but you guys being the safety net, and just to be clear with everybody, a non-denominational mm-hmm. safety net for everybody, which as a former sailor, again, limited in time, it is something that's really positive. But pivoting a little bit to also, you talk about, you know, the digital natives here, and I love that, you know, because we are an immigrant to digital world. As you pivot to the natives, there's a little bit of a double-edged sword, and that is, you know, autonomous shipping. Are you guys dealing with that yet? I just dropped a podcast the other day with Admiral John Mauger, and he was talking about the Coast Guard's role in digital, in autonomous shipping. And it's a really interesting thing, because he said they have to look at it before you get into the rule, before you get into the actual machinery. They're also looking at it from the rules. Is it implied that somebody's going to hear something and do it, or is it implicit or explicit? And it gets into the really nuance of the rules, and that blew me away. But from a training point of view and dealing with a lot more of the digital natives, are you sensing some apprehension about this? Are you sensing, you know, what are you guys sensing, especially more on the training side?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think, you know, we've been talking for years about autonomously operated vessels and the declining need for seafarers, but we're certainly not there yet. Leave it that full stop. From a training perspective, well, let me digress for a minute. I actually, all of last week, was in Norway at a conference with Kongsberg, the big simulator company, operator company. And it was a user conference, and people from all over the world came to this. And one of the work breakout groups that I went to actually took me to a center called Masterly. And so Masterly is it's a Masterly remote operation center. It's a joint partnership between Kongsberg and the big Norwegian shipping company Wilhelmsen. And they actually operate from this center a fully autonomous vessel, where they pilot it across the fjord and run a service on a sort of a short haul, short sea shipping kind of container route. And they're testing the technology. and they hope to be fully autonomous with nobody on board vessel by 2026. I think they make the argument that works well in a short sea, kind of planned route, consistent route sort of operation. And it obviously lowers operating costs and all those sorts of things. But what they're trying to do is it's an initiative to be more green friendly, to try and take 40,000 semi-tractor trailers off the road and to basically go to this sort of fully electric powered vessel, battery operated vessel, fully autonomous vessel. The crew is actually based on the third floor of this remote operation center and consists of a captain with a 6-hour watch and three engineers. And the question for the industry is, and probably what Admiral Mauger was thinking, is how do we define how many ships can a captain control at one time? And what does it mean to have minimal crewing and minimal staffing on a vessel if nobody is physically on board the vessel? So I think those are, you know, those are kind of some big questions. And then you look at the deep sea shipping part. There were several people from the Norwegian Navy, Swedish Navy, Royal Canadian Navy, and you know, their concern was when you move to autonomous vessels, what happens with piracy? And what happens when you now have not just one or two, but you have 6,000 ships at sea far away from shore? And what do we do with hackers and the ability to sort of take control of these vessels and piracy issues, which is what they're most concerned about? But again, that's a completely different kind of question. I think for deep sea shipping, the autonomous piece is how do we do remote support for the crew that's still on board? So we can reduce the crew size, think of an engineering department. And then a lot of the support can be done from shoreside, and even a lot of the corrections from the engineering perspective could be activated from shoreside to the vessel, to the ship's operating plant. That's sort of interesting. Now, they pointed out in some ways that's kind of similar to how dynamic positioning or DP shipping happens now. You know, they said if you're a master of a DP ship, you know, often you're on cruise control going out to the point. They referred to it as 99% boredom and 1% sheer panic. So I think that's probably true. So how do we train for that? Well, on simulators, it doesn't matter to us necessarily if we're training a master or a captain to be physically aboard the vessel and to be able to pilot it, or to be at a remote center where all of the controls and the monitors look exactly the same, and you have perhaps 12 screens in front of you, and you're piloting the vessel much the way a drone pilot pilots a vessel from Homestead, Florida, rather than being based in Iraq. So I think the possibilities are there. I think the ability to train is still there. Ultimately, is going to be where are the crew members going to be based?
So talk about Admiral Mauger. We talked about autonomous shipping lends itself well to the three Ds. I think it was dirty, dangerous, and dull. I think that's what they were. And it was basically, is this a dull route? Is this, you know, either dangerous cargoes? And what I keep hearing, because I've had a few people talk about autonomous shipping, including Salvatore D'Amico, and he said, you know, we're not replacing the crews. What we're going to do is we're going to help you do your job better. And I've heard this a few times where you're going to keep the humans going to be in the loop, but maybe there is a case for short sea shipping where you have going, you know, back and forth the same place where there's no risk of piracy, you know, across Cape Cod or something, you know, across Long Island Sound, across Chesapeake Bay. How much risk of piracy is there? There's more risk of somebody having too much to drink and running their, you know, 40-foot whaler into your boat than pirates. As to your point, taking cargo off the road and things like that is super important. I also know, you know, seafarers are worried about replacing their jobs. I just think they're going to look different. And I think it'll be more in tune to what digital natives are used to. But I do think that that's going to be important. Pivoting a little bit, you touched upon it a little bit further. Some of the folks don't know. Well, people know who listen to the podcast. I'm a SUNY Maritime grad. And I know you guys have had some of the chaplains on board the cruise. You did this for a few cycles, and it sounds like you're going to continue. The question I have is, what advice would you be giving to the students going forward? You kind of touched upon a little bit, but not necessarily for digital, but for kind of all things as the chaplains have come back and given the feedback.
Yeah, that's a good question. And you're right. We've been privileged to actually sail the last two summer sea terms with SUNY Maritime on the training ship Empire State. And it's been a positive experience to have chaplains on board, not for religious purposes per se, but really for mental health and sort of resilient support. And we've expanded that to now having chaplain basically there for all 10 days of NDOC, which is great for the cadets coming in. And we're looking for additional opportunities to be supportive, not only at SUNY, but also the other maritime colleges that are reaching out to us. But if I were, you know, if I were a cadet, and let me just back up and give another plug for the cadets I met at SUNY Maritime. When I was 18 years old, I was not that squared away, that buttoned down, or not that committed in what I wanted to do with the rest of my life.
Hey, I went to that school, neither was I. I thought I was, but.
So I look at these cadets, and they know, they're very clear. This is an investment in my future. This is what I want to do. You know, I want to graduate. Most of them, unlike, you know, other maritime academies in the area, most of these graduates actually sail on their license. And so they'll go to sea and it's part of their career path. And they feel very committed to that. So I'm a bit in awe of people who are that clear on what they want to do. But my advice would be really to make sure that you build sort of a strong support network of family, colleagues, and contacts, because that's what's going to sustain you in your career. You're going to have, you know, I think the expression is, you know, happy wife, happy life, or you're only as happy as your least happy child. You know, if you can make sure that your family's squared away and that you're looking after them and you feel confident, you're going to have a better career as a seafarer when you're at sea. Similarly, having a close group of colleagues, people that you really know that you can depend on, is important. So that's part of building that sort of support or safety network. And then I think also, how do you build out your own resilient skills? Because that's going to be the most important. There are times of isolation. You are going to be at sea for months at a time. And what are you going to need to sustain and support you? One of the things I think that's been helpful, probably accelerated because of COVID, is an awareness of what isolation does to mental health challenges and concerns amongst seafarers and the population at large. And being able to name that and be aware that this is just like any kind of physical ailment, something that's treatable and can be supported with counseling support, medication, things that are all approved. But to develop an understanding of sort of mental health issues, depression, et cetera, and really to know what your resources are when you're at sea so you can depend on them and not feel isolated. And I think also looking out and being able to look at your crew members and your crewmates and making sure that you're always trying to make sure that everyone's at their best, because you're only as strong as a crew as your weakest member. And so I think it's really about building your own network, building your own support network, making sure that you build your own resiliency skills, and then carrying that to sea with you when you're aboard ship.
From a personal point of view, you know, I know just the resiliency word and stick-to-itiveness and things like that, because I think this is all good. And I feel that I'm pretty typical of a lot of people that pass through the school. I think there are a lot of folks who spend 20, 25 years out at sea and you know, sales captain or pilot or what have you. But I think there's a large majority that do 5 years, 4 years, like I did, 5 years, other people, somewhere in that range. And then you get these skill sets, because then they do transfer really well to shore-based roles, whether they're in operations, chartering, or sales, or whatever. It could be a variety of roles, and it doesn't matter which one of the schools that you went to. It's certainly all the opportunities are there. But I do think that kind of working on that, especially your network, I think that one of the most important things that SUNY taught me, and I've posted about it a few times, and I think all the other schools do a really good job, is that you have this kind of built-in network of people, and you don't have to be best friends with them, but you have this network of people, whether it's for just seeing somebody at an event that happens to be overseas and you went to school with them. That's pretty amazing. Not a lot of other schools offer that opportunity. And even, you know, some of the top name Ivy League schools, you just don't get that because of the career path that you're in. It's a little harder to do. So I think that that's definitely one of the real positive things here. As we start to come close to our time, I love to ask people these things and been answered a different way. What are you reading these days? Because I've also been answered with, well, I'm actually writing something. I think I've interviewed probably about 20 people or so far, maybe 18. And I've had about three or four people say they're writing some stuff. Are you reading anything interesting, or are you writing something now that's pretty good? Where do you stand on that? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think I'm reading and writing, and I suppose I'm probably doing math as well at times. But let's see. Reading. Yeah. So there was a book that was reviewed maybe 3 weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal. And it was a book I'd never heard of, called The Big Sea. And it's actually an autobiography by Langston Hughes, the Harlem Renaissance author and poet. And it's about it's just a collection of vignettes or short stories, reflections about his own life. So it was written in the 1940s, but in the early 1920s, he actually went to sea as a steward aboard a cargo ship. And there's a wonderful, the first story in that collection is called Sandy Hook. And it's about crossing the bar at Sandy Hook on a trip to Africa, where he was a steward on the, I think it was the SS Malone. And it's just a great sort of introduction to his life and what forms him as an author and as a writer. So I've been reading that because I thought that was interesting. And then I finished a book a couple of weeks ago called The Sewing Girl's Tale, which is the story about, quite frankly, it's about a 15-year-old girl who was sexually molested by a wealthier aristocrat in Lower Manhattan in the 1780s of all times. And I actually could not help but read that in light of everything happening with regard to sexual assault and sexual harassment in the world around us, at the Maritime Academies, certainly with King's Point, and how this woman and her family were sort of treated in trying to prove this case, which ultimately does change jurisprudence in the United States around assault cases against women. And it's an interesting sort of trajectory of how the legal profession changes around that. But it was written by a historian at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill named John Wood Sweet. So that's a sort of a fiction and a nonfiction book that I was reading of late.
And you're writing stuff? Are you writing anything of interest?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's of interest, but yeah, I'm always having to write things. So I just wrote something for the Journal of Commerce, which, no surprise, is all about how important it is to be able to educate, train, and retain a well-trained, highly skilled core of seafarers, both men and women, to crew these vessels. And at the same time, talking about the need for internet access aboard ships as a way of making sure we can keep people connected to this industry and not saying, you know, that's a bridge too far for me. I don't want to give all of that up. And, you know, I want to be able to have both of those. So that's a piece for the Journal of Commerce. We have we write quarterly magazines. One's called The Lookout. And I just finished a piece looking at actually the summer sea term for 2022, which will be the last cruise aboard the Empire State Six. So
I hope you got your T-shirt there. One of my classmates is putting together T-shirts that says the last cruise, and I cruise around my hometown. I think people look at me like I'm some far out guy. Like, what are you wearing that for? I usually read a lot of nonfiction, but I'm reading some fiction. Nelson DeMille, The Cuban Affair. Pretty interesting. Okay. He writes, you know, Plum Island and some other really famous ones. I kind of started to read into that on a recent trip to. So I really appreciate you coming on, Mark. Thank you so much. This was great. Hopefully everybody got a little something out of it, and not only what you do, but what the Seamus Church does. And we joked around earlier about a hat. One of the important things at the Seamus Church, I know you guys are getting geared up, probably have been for a while, is during this time of year, you have a bunch of your supporters will knit hats, right? And especially for the seafarers who are from baby countries that don't have cold weather, the Philippines and Indonesia, and they don't have the cold weather, and they knit hats. And I was on a ship in 1991, although I'm a native New Yorker, and we were, I think, in South Carolina, and it was particularly cold, and I have a light blue knitted hat floating around my house somewhere that's 30-something years old. And tell us a little bit about that. And by the way, I will be putting a plug for donations to Seamus Church in the notes for everybody. I do think it's a good cause. But tell us a little bit about that as we wrap up.
Sure. So, yeah, that Christmas at Sea is our most iconic program. It dates to 1898. We started it during the midst of the Spanish-American War, knitting knitted hats for really sailors and also merchant mariners. And it's continued every year. We're going to be celebrating our 125th anniversary of that program next year. We now have knitters in all 50 states and in, I think, four countries who knit somewhere around 20,000 plus hand-knitted scarves and hats that we then distribute to international seafarers and domestic mariners. And I'm in the port today, and outside my door there are these Santa sacks. So each Santa sack has 12 ditty bags in it. The ditty bags are also handmade, two knitted items in each ditty bag, some toiletries, candies and sweets. Those go to a Santa sack, and then our chaplains will spend every day between the Monday after Thanksgiving until the Feast of the Epiphany on January 6th, delivering these Santa sacks full of ditty bags to all these seafarers. And we'll do it both in the ports, and we'll also do it on the U.S. river system and on the intercoastal waterway. So great program, great volunteers, and yeah, quite iconic. And I've met so many people who still have their ditty bags, still have their hats from 30 years earlier. So.
Yeah, I have mine. And if you're listening to the podcast and you've gotten this far, thank you. And then, of course, post your pictures or whatever of ditty bags and hats. I'll see if I can find mine. I know it's around here somewhere. But anyway, in conclusion, Reverend Nestlehut, thank you for coming on the podcast. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Chris. And thanks for all that you do.
I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode of The Last Dinosaur. To learn more about the mission of SCI, please check the show notes. I have never asked for donations on this podcast before, and as I mentioned during the show, but given the holiday season and much of what SCI does relies on donation, and this goes to sailors, the lifeblood of our industry, please take a moment and consider donating. I'll also put that link in the show notes. The Last Dinosaur can be found in all the places you normally get your podcasts, such as iTunes, Amazon, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and on a YouTube channel. Don't forget to like, follow, subscribe. Once again, I'm your host, Chris Aversano, wishing you all fair winds and following seas.